I'd like to bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. It is Thursday, February 14th, Oregon's birthday and Valentine's Day. With that, we have a few bills for first public hearing and a work session scheduled today. And Bob, do we have any introduction of committee measures today? Okay. So with that, I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2239. Bob, why don't you refresh our memory about House Bill 2239.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2239 limits the exemption from Oregon mortgage lender law for financial holding company or bank holding company to entities that do no more than control a subsidiary or affiliate and do not engage in the business of a mortgage banker or mortgage broker. The bill has no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Thank you. Representative Lively.
I would move that House Bill 2239 be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2239 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee. And committee, I will note that I just received and passed out some information from DCBS on this bill, talking about some of the issues that came up at our public hearing.
Mr. Chair. I know that sometimes time is of the essence in these matters, but if there's any way to possibly get this kind of information before we approach the dais, that'd be helpful for me. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I didn't really have it, and it's just additional information. I don't know that was extremely pertinent to the bill itself, though the bill does, these issues are affected by the bill. Any other discussion? Seeing none, Samantha, could we have a vote, please?
Representative Daugherty?
Yes.
Representative Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Penny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Excused.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Chair Holdy?
Aye. House Bill 2239, having received the votes, is passed. A unanimous vote. I don't know that this one should be on the consent calendar, so I am going to ask for a carrier. Anybody interested in carrying this?
I'll do it.
I guess I'll carry this one. You've carried way too much lately. You want to carry all the weight. So with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2239. And I'm combing the crowd. I don't see the crowd. So with that, I'm going to move into open a public hearing on House Bill 2060. Bob, would you give us a little description of House Bill 2060, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2060 allows the Attorney General to issue an order disqualifying charitable organization that fails to expend at least 30% of expenses on program services from receiving tax-deductible contributions. It requires disqualified organization to disclose when soliciting the contributions are not deductible for state income tax purposes, and it specifies certain exempt organizations.
So I have on the list Ellen Rosenblum and Elizabeth Grant. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Ellen Rosenblum, Oregon Attorney General, on behalf of the Oregon Department of Justice.
And for the record, my name is Elizabeth Grant. I'm the attorney in charge of the charitable activity section at the Oregon Department of Justice.
Thank you. And proceed with your testimony on this bill, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. I want to thank the committee for considering a consumer protection proposal this afternoon to curb the activities of organizations that are abusing the tax benefits conferred upon charities and taking advantage of the generosity of Oregon donors. House Bill 2060 would be the first law of its kind in the country to use the tax code to combat charities that exist primarily for the benefit of their fundraisers and managers and do little in the way of public good with the donations and tax benefits they receive. House Bill 2060 enables the Attorney General to disqualify certain charities from being eligible to receive tax-deductible donations for Oregon income tax purposes if they spend less than 30% of donations on charitable programs, also referred to as program services, averaged over the past three years. It would also require the charity to disclose in solicitations and in written documentation provided to the donors that contributions to it are not tax deductible for Oregon income tax purposes. And if the organization fails to make those disclosures, it would be engaged in deceptive practices and subject to legal action.
Move back from the mic or move the mic away from you a little bit. Those mics are really sensitive, and if you're not used to them, it distorts a little bit. Thank you. Hate to break your
I apologize.
I want you to sound good.
Getting used to this microphone. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. So if the organization failed to make those disclosures, it would be engaged in deceptive practices and subject to legal action under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, including potential civil penalties up to $25,000 per violation. So we anticipate that if this legislation is enacted, many of the organizations that would be impacted will make the decision simply not to solicit in Oregon. And we also believe that if donors knew how little of their contributions went to the organization's stated charitable purposes, they would choose not to donate. The law's disclosure requirements will place donors on notice that the organization is one they may choose not to support. You may know that for the last few years around the holidays, the Department of Justice has published a list of the 20 worst charities. It's one of our most popular consumer protection items. These are the worst charities registered to solicit in Oregon, almost all of which were headquartered out of state. But nevertheless, they do solicit here in our state. And those lists were generated using the very same criteria that's included in House Bill 2060. So we already do the work, and this would simply allow us to use the data that we have to require these charities to comply with the law. A couple of examples from those lists include Firefighters Support Foundation, a Massachusetts-based charity that claims to assist firefighters and rescue personnel in performing their jobs effectively and safely. And it's received more than $3 million in annual donations from the public, including Oregon solicitations, but has devoted only 7% of its expenditures to advancing its charitable purposes. And it spends the vast majority of its resources on professional fundraisers and administration. Another one, for one more example, the Committee for Missing Children, based in Georgia, receives more than $2 million in donations every year, but spends only about 12% on its purpose to locate missing children, with most of the rest of the money, again, being paid to its professional fundraisers. Many people who view this 20 worst list have told us that they're surprised to learn that there are no laws that require charities to expend a reasonable portion of donations on their charitable programs. Under existing law, even though charities like those named in these lists are easily identified from the financial reports that they're required to file with the Department of Justice, we can do little more than warn the donors that some organizations may, in fact, not be as charitable as they appear. So House Bill 2060 provides a mechanism that enables the Department of Justice to do more than simply report and educate. This legislation combats the problem of charities that abuse the system and take advantage of donors by imposing minimal standards on eligibility for tax-deductible contributions and by authorizing the department to enforce those standards by issuing orders that disqualify certain charities from claiming those tax advantages in Oregon. I would now like, with your permission, Mr. Chair, to ask Elizabeth Grant to provide some more details on how this legislation would work in practice.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Elizabeth Grant, and I'm the attorney in charge of the Department of Justice's Charitable Activities Section. I want to thank the committee for allowing me to provide some additional information on this legislation. To provide some background about how a charity becomes eligible to receive tax-deductible donations, in order for that to happen, it must first apply to the IRS for recognition as a charity. This is generally referred to as IRS 501c3 status. Currently, donations to 501c3 organizations are deductible for Oregon income tax purposes, the same extent they are for federal income tax purposes. Once an organization receives 501c3 status, as a condition of maintaining that status, it's required to file an annual financial report with the Internal Revenue Service. This report is called a Form 990. If the organization intends to solicit or do business in Oregon, it must also register and file copies of those same reports with the Charitable Activities Section. When an organization has 200 or 1,000 or more in gross revenues, they're required to allocate their expenditures between charitable programs, management, and fundraising. Our office tracks this data, as the Attorney General stated, and we're able to identify some charities that collect millions and still spend very, very little on their charitable programs. But as has been stated previously, up until now, we haven't been able to do much about that other than to note the existence of such organizations. To provide some additional context about why we believe HB 2060 is the right answer, back in the 1980s, a number of states, including Oregon, attempted to address this problem by barring charities from soliciting in the state unless they spent certain amounts on charitable programs. However, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected those statutes as overbroad and concluded that barring organizations from soliciting based upon administrative expense ratio was a violation of the First Amendment. But the distinction in this legislation is it doesn't bar anybody from soliciting. The organizations are still free to continue to solicit in Oregon. After the Supreme Court rulings, there was a proliferation of charities that are closely linked to professional fundraisers. In many cases, the fundraisers agree to solicit donations from the public in exchange for a percentage of the donations received. And oftentimes, increasingly more frequently, this percentage is often along the lines of 80 or 85% to the professional fundraisers. The managers of the charities then take a small portion for themselves to pay their own salaries, and that leaves very little to go to the charitable causes. In some instances, we're able to take action against these types of organizations when they make specific misleading claims about how donations will be used. However, in many other instances, the scripts and solicitation materials are very general and not actionable. For example, they may just say, we will help veterans with your contribution. We doubt that many Oregonians would contribute if they knew how little money was actually going to the cause, but that still doesn't mean we're able to take action right now. But HB 2060 offers a solution to this problem. Unlike the statutes rejected by the Supreme Court, as I noted before, this doesn't prevent anybody from soliciting in the state. It merely eliminates the tax subsidies that encourage people to donate to such organizations, and it requires appropriate disclosures of the information to the public, which does not raise constitutional issues. To tell you just a little bit more about how the statute would operate in practice, as we have stated, we would use charities' own reports to determine if it is meeting the expenditure threshold. As I mentioned before, the 990 contains the breakdown on what the charity itself reports that it's spending in terms of fundraising and management and program services. If we identified a charity that was not meeting the applicable threshold, we would notify the charity of that, and the charity would have an opportunity to request a hearing under the Administrative Procedures Act. If the disqualification finding was upheld, the disqualification order would issue, and that would trigger the requirements for disclosure to prospective donors here in Oregon, that the contributions are not tax deductible for Oregon income tax purposes. In addition, we would publish the list of disqualified charities on the internet to make that information available and work with the Department of Revenue to ensure it's able to use that information as well. The legislation amends the tax code to eliminate the deductibility of contributions to organizations that the Attorney General has identified as being disqualified. There is some safeguards in there if the taxpayer receives a written document from the organization that fails to include a disclosure, then it would be eligible to take that donation. But we would hope that instead what would be happening is the organizations would either choose to not solicit here in Oregon, or they would give the consumer a document before they contribute, so the consumer would be on notice that their donation was not tax deductible. I would be happy to answer any additional questions the committee might have. Thank you once again.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I ask a series of questions?
As long as they don't take more than half an hour.
Absolutely. Just to start off, what you've just said, to make sure I understand, is that the Supreme Court has come up with their holding that says that the charity can solicit in Oregon. You can't stop that as long as they qualify with their 990. And a person, so what you're saying is we're going to punish the donor in Oregon for giving to a charity that may be violating law in Oregon, although we don't have any authority over the charity. But the donor's protected because if the charity doesn't send a statement to the donor saying we don't qualify because we violated Oregon law, then the donor can still take the deduction.
May I take this opportunity to respond?
Yes, I guess it was a question.
Am I hearing you correctly?
Well, to offer a little bit of clarification, at the Supreme Court, you cannot always stop organizations that are engaged in fraudulent solicitations. In this case, and donors, taxpayers, are responsible for getting the documentation and for taking appropriate tax deductions in general. If you claim a charitable deduction, you need to have the paperwork to show that the organization that you contributed to was in fact a charity and that you have supporting documentation to show that. So in the case where in the ordinary case, which I indicated, assuming the organization that's soliciting here is complying with the law, then the donor would get some acknowledgement or would get information that their donation to that charity was not tax deductible.
Okay, no. So you said what I just said. So, but if they don't comply with the law, you have no authority over them to make them send that notice when they say thank you for donating $100. If they don't put a notice and saying, by the way, we don't qualify for you to deduct this, you really can't do anything against them because they have a right to solicit under the First Amendment.
They do have a right to solicit, but we would be able to go after them for engaging in unlawful trade practices. They would basically be misleading the donor about their status here in Oregon, and that could result in penalties of up to $25,000 per violation. So that's why we don't think many organizations that fall into this category are going to take a big risk if they choose to mislead their donors in that way.
Okay.
So we would be able to take action.
I'm going to kind of speed it up because I don't want to dominate too much time. How did you come up with 30%? Why not 35% or 50% or 75%?
Well, one way that I say to look at this, there is some dispute about how important administrative ratios and fundraising ratios are. And I think that we can agree, we may not all agree on what the right number is, but we can probably all agree on what the wrong number is. And this is, we feel that the 30% is the wrong number. And there's generally, I think, consensus around the fact that organizations that fall at that threshold or below are not doing an effective job at their charitable purpose. As you increase that threshold, there's a possibility that the charity might have just had a bad year or a series of bad years, but is still contributing to their communities and may turn things around. But we think that there's a sort of a consensus around that 30% number as being just unacceptably low.
Okay. You said two examples were given. One has collected it's nationally and maybe globally, they one collected $7 million and the other collected $2 million. I don't know how much of Oregon's money went toward that, but those are really kind of low numbers for charities. Why is this a driving issue that Oregon needs to be the first in the country to lead out, to have the Attorney General's office be overseeing charitable deductions?
Oregon has a fairly strong Office of Charitable Regulation to begin with, stronger than exists in some other states. And I think if you think about, these are the organizations, I mean, $3 million, $7 million, to me that seems like a lot of money. That's actually a fairly big charity, maybe not, you know, compared to big national charities, but that's still a lot of money. And these are the organizations that are calling our grandmothers, our family members at home. I mean, these are organizations that have a lot of contact when they do solicit in Oregon because they do call so many people. And even though they may not be raising much money, the overall impact they have on the perspective of the sector, they're, you know, to have these bad apples out there where people say you can't really do anything about it and you can't trust, you know, you just have to not trust. We don't want the message to be that you can't trust charities. So it's important to do something about the organizations that are abusing that trust.
Okay, I'd like to go to the finances of this. Oregon has about a little over 1% of the population of America. If it's a charity, you know, the two examples you've come up, one is $7 million and the other is $2 million. Say we are really generous here and we give 10%. So we give $700,000 or maybe $70,000 to one and $20,000 or a couple hundred thousand to the other. This is going to cost your organization because, you know, you're going to be enforcing, you're going to be not just doing what you've been doing in the past, but actually enforcing this, sending out notices, evaluating 990s and all of these things. Is it really something that the AG's office ought to be expending resources on when you may end up spending more resources than what Oregon donors are choosing to give just to protect them from themselves because they're making, they're writing the checks. Nobody's forcing them to do it.
Well, I think that what will happen in this context is that we're just be going about enforcement in a slightly different way. I mean, we're already taking a look at these organizations. They're already soliciting donations from Oregonians and causing injury. We end up sort of looking at their scripts or trying to find ways to identify whether they've misled people or not. And in fact, this legislation, I think, provides a cleaner, faster, more efficient use of resources. An administrative proceeding is generally more efficient than court litigation, which can be very expensive. I mean, sometimes we have had situations where we have gone into court to prevent organizations from soliciting in the state, but that can be very resource intensive and require some considerable amount of resources. Our best guess is that we would be able to administer this statute pretty cost effectively and pretty efficiently.
Okay, just one final question then. In our determination as to whether we should go forward with this, is there a burning reason? I mean, have there been a whole series of complaints where people have said, I've given money and I find out now that they're not using it very well, and so will you protect me from not doing this in the future? Or is this something that kind of the office has decided, we really need to do this to protect people who may be hoodwinked because they didn't look at your number one site on the AG's website right now?
Well, one thing that makes charitable regulation especially challenging is that it doesn't generally attract a lot of complaints. But for one thing, people gave because they trusted and they believed in the organization, and so they don't necessarily go back and aren't skeptical. Even if they are skeptical or realize afterwards, it's sort of hard. They don't have that much ability sort of starting to comb through a 990 to determine what the charity did with their money. It actually takes some sort of regulatory expertise and somebody who's sort of used to looking at and working with 990s to sort of understand what all of the numbers mean in that document. So that's why it's, even though there's not complaints, I don't know that there's necessarily been a groundswell, although many people have supported this legislation. But it is because we keep seeing the same charities over and over again that are soliciting and making money in this way, and we think it's not good for the integrity of the charitable sector for that to continue. And so that's part of our motivation for this, encouraging the support of this legislation.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Chair, I would just like to mention that there at Christmas time, there's a law firm actually out of Boston that does toys that kill, and they list these toys, and they just publicize it, and it gets picked up, you know, because people are really interested, and they talk about toys that have little bearings and things like that that kids might ingest and those kinds of things. If the AG's office were to say charities that are stealing your money or something like that, and just publicize what you're already learning from your website, maybe people could then make their own decision as to whether they want to do it or not do it without having to have the resources of the AG's office to try and punish those that are doing something that the Supreme Court has already said is legal for them to do, but maybe you found a way of getting around the Supreme Court's position. And so anyway, just thought that maybe there's another way to do it.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Now, I would ask another question to follow up on that. It's essentially, if these charitable organizations are essentially misrepresenting themselves and what they're able to provide the consumer, and in regards to that, is that not an unlawful trade practice in most industries that the Attorney General would be able to take action on?
Chair Holvey, I would agree that in most circumstances, it does seem like this is material information that isn't being presented to donors. But with the background of the Supreme Court, which they said that the fundraising ratio in and of itself is not a material misrepresentation, that sort of limits what people might consider traditional consumer protection remedies in this area, which is why HB 2060 is necessary.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you coming forward, and I can appreciate the cause. I guess I would argue that in as much as some charities are trying to take advantage of donors, some are just trying to avoid taxation. I have a couple questions here. Isn't it the Internal Revenue Service that determines the eligibility for a 501c3?
That's correct.
Okay. Would it make sense for our Attorney General to work with the Internal Revenue Service to try and resolve this issue rather than us at the state level, 1% of the entire population, of the nation's population, to take this on?
We do inform the IRS when the occasion arises of organizations that we believe may be abusing their tax-exempt status. But the IRS is probably overworked in this area as equally overworked. There's over 1.2 million 501c3 organizations that are doing this. And also the IRS is prohibited from sharing information with our office when it does take action, which makes it somewhat difficult to coordinate activities in this area. But we feel that this is something we're already engaged in charitable enforcement, and this is already affecting donors here in Oregon.
So just one or two more follow-ups here. So according to the information before me, a nonprofit that's violating what would be statute would no longer be eligible for Oregon tax benefit, but they would still be eligible for federal tax benefit.
That's correct, because Oregon, we don't have the authority to change the federal 501c3 designation.
I appreciate that what you're trying to accomplish. To me, what makes perhaps more sense is for the Attorney General and the IRS to work together to help better determine what is a real charity versus one that's trying to avoid taxation. Thank you.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this to our attention. I really applaud what you are trying to do. I think both in terms of consumer protection, I think you made a great start with your 20 worst charities, so that gets a little bit at what Representative Richardson was saying. Unfortunately, not everyone gets to see that. In terms of holding charitable organizations accountable. I appreciate the effort in that regard as well. I come out of the nonprofit sector, and I know that one bad apple can tarnish the reputation of many, so I appreciate that. I really appreciate nonprofits that make a clear distinction when they solicit. One of the obvious ones that come to mind is Stand for Children. Stand for Children Leadership Center, they go out, is the nonprofit 501c3. They can go out to foundations and get big grants. And when they do their individual solicitations, it's usually just Stand for Children because they want to be able to use more of their money for advocacy. And so they have a very clear line at the bottom saying that money that is collected through this is not tax deductible, and so there are a lot of groups that are very good players, and in fact they have a third category that's a PAC, so they make a very clear distinction, as a lot of groups do. So I think I want to applaud the organizations, the many nonprofits out there that do a really good job, and anything that we can do as a public sector to work to have that sector more accountable, I appreciate that effort. Lastly, there's the interest of the state. We are losing tax dollars because of giving a tax deduction to organizations that may not be good players. And that's the kind of gray pioneer effort. You know, I love this idea because sometimes I think states are the grounds of innovation and need to get out there. And yes, I would love to see the IRS take this on. So in regard to that last question, I'm wondering how many organizations, you have the 20 worst that are giving less than 25% back to the purpose. You're now proposing 30%. Could you tell us how many organizations, and have you done an analysis of what are the state income tax dollars that we lose as a result of those?
Well, we don't have good figures on what the amount of donations are to these organizations. And in addition to the loss of tax dollars, we think that the pool of charitable donations is limited. So part of what's happening is money is going to these organizations when it might be better off going to other organizations. But to address your other question about how many organizations are there, we still think that the pool of organizations that will fall in this legislation is going to be relatively limited, maybe 100 or less, which is part of the reason why we think we can manage the work that's associated with this. But ultimately, we again believe that many of these organizations will decide to leave Oregon, so there may be less work involved. Partly, I suppose, to some extent, we're sort of victims of our own success. I could say that the problem would be worse, except for we already spend a lot of time sort of targeting these organizations that are maybe making misleading representations or that seem to be engaged in private profiting off of charitable activity. But
thank you. I think we are going to move on now. We have another testifier on this. I appreciate your time today and bringing this issue to us is really appreciated. I think it is an area that deserves a very close look.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We appreciate your attention and your questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Up next, we have James White. Good afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Holvey. My name is James White. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and I am the Executive Director of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon.
And I am Ross Laybourne, Vice President of the Board of Directors of the Nonprofit Association of Oregon.
Thank you.
The Nonprofit Association of Oregon supports HB 2060, and we'd like to state our reasons for our support. The nonprofit community in Oregon helps our communities thrive, and they help us in times of need. We recognize that the ability for nonprofits to uphold the precious resources entrusted to them through the tax-exempt status that we've been given by the government is a very important trust that we have with the public and with the government sector, with the public sector. We seek to be good stewards of those financial resources in the public's trust. And it deeply concerns our organization that there are these, there is this small group of people of these organizations that give the nonprofit sector a bad name. Our organization is a membership organization representing 600 nonprofits and affiliate members across the state of Oregon. We are here to strengthen the voice, the capacity, and the leadership of nonprofits to enrich the lives of all Oregonians. So we see it very much as part of our role as the Nonprofit Association of Oregon to support a bill like HB 2060, where we recognize there are there's a public trust issue that is being abridged, that's being confronted. I'd like to, you have our written testimony, but I'd like to maybe just go into some of the points that I think would answer some of the questions around numbers like 30%, why 30% might be a good number. The Better Business Bureau uses a 65% average as a mean to create an understanding that on what how much a qualifying charity must spend of their total expenses on their charitable program activities. That 65% gives a good target norm for our sector to aspire to, but it should in no way be considered a floor, a minimum. The organization Charity Navigator, which is America's leading independent charity evaluator, rates over 6,000 of the largest charities in the nation and provides a four-star rating system as it means to educate potential funders on the financial health and accountability and transparency of those organizations. They use a matrix that includes expenditures related to an organization's charitable programming. Within Charity Navigator's matrix, it's instructive to understand that what happens when a charity falls below a one-third of revenue being expended on charitable programming. And I want to read to you off of the Charity Navigator website. They say, our data shows that 7 out of 10 charities we've evaluated spend at least 75% of their budget on the programs and services they exist to provide. 9 out of 10 spend at least 65%. We believe that those spending less than a third of their budget on program expenses are simply not living up to their missions. Charities demonstrating such gross inefficiency receive a 0-star rating for their financial health. Now, that's a national charity evaluating service. Oregon doesn't have that capacity through an organization like ours, through the Nonprofit Association. Those 6,000 that get rated through Charity Navigator, there's probably only maybe, you know, a couple of dozen that are actually based here in Oregon. So for the benefit of the consumer, the people in Oregon, we feel it's very appropriate to have a number to set a floor at some 30% number, I mean 33, you know, whether it's 33 and a third, 30%, we feel that that's an appropriate minimum that an organization should meet, and we believe that HB 2060 has enough exceptions that can be discussed and evaluated and understood between the charity and the DOJ's office to allow for exceptional circumstances when an organization might be engaged in a capital campaign or some other activity that suddenly causes them to go to dip into even that 30% level. So we feel like there's enough built in this bill that's proposed to be able to support from our side. So I'll stop there and answer any of your questions.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Do you have any testimony you'd like to add?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, again, my name is Ross Laybourne. So I kind of have two hats. One, as I told you, Vice President of the Board of Directors of NAO. In my former life, I was an Assistant Attorney General and in charge of the Charitable Activities section. So I guess I'm largely here as a resource for the committee if you have any questions of me in terms of my background in that role.
Thank you. Any questions from the committee for this panel? Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if most of these organizations would have a charity navigator designation, and if so, whether that 33.3% would make more sense than 30, because we're not trying to figure out who of those that get the zero rating fall between 33% and 30%. It seems like a clear delineation. Just wonder if you can comment on that.
I wouldn't know which ones do or don't. Again, there's I think Liz testified that there was over a million Charity Navigator evaluates 6,000 of the largest. So those organizations are probably in some way seeking to dodge getting on Charity Navigator's list for evaluation, would be my guess. But I don't have any specific knowledge.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? I really appreciate you coming down and speaking up for the Nonprofit Association and letting us know how you feel about this bill in terms of your enterprises.
Thank you for
charities. They are an important piece of our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. If I might make one final comment, sorry.
Certainly.
I do think that I understand that there's a federal-state issue at play here, and I do think that the innovation that Oregonians show in giving it higher than national average at every economic level across the across the state to our charities, volunteering at 35.8%, which ranks us eighth in the nation in volunteerism, shows the kind of spirit of innovation and volunteerism that is the backbone of the pioneer spirit of Oregonians. And this is an issue that is in the front of a lot of minds. In fact, today in the Chronicle of Philanthropy, this exact issue is being discussed. Mm-hmm. Front page. No one is talking about the floor. They're talking about how to slice and dice and figure out who should qualify for what levels. But to set a minimum floor, we feel is extremely appropriate. So you would encourage.
And you generated one question for me before I really need to move on. So when nonprofit organizations own property, do they also get property tax exemptions?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you very much, and I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2060. And I'd like to open. And I would.
Good point. It took me a minute, Repo. That's a good point.
No, we don't want to punish just the contributors, do we?
Yeah, that's a very good point raised.
With that, I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2536. Bob, give us a brief little summary of House Bill 2536, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2536 requires quarter administrative authority to make additional specific findings before approving an agreement for transfer of structural settlement rights. It also extends the period in which a transfer agreement may be canceled by the settlement payee.
Thank you. And I know we recognize Representative Barton, who's been patiently waiting and for me. He wanted to speak on this bill. So
thank
welcome,
you,
Representative Barton. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the House Committee on Consumer Protection. It's nice to be back. My name is Brent Barton. I represent House District 40. I served on this committee in 2009. As I look around today, it seems like there's been 100% turnover since those times, except, of course, Chair Holvey.
Still could be 100%.
I'm here today to testify in favor of House Bill 2536. I should note that I was in no way involved in the preparation of this bill, and indeed, I actually had not read this bill until this morning. I try to keep abreast of what our legislature is doing, certainly our chamber is doing, and I noticed this bill today, and actually indeed just went into Chair Holvey's office this morning and asked if his permission to come and testify on this. So that's perhaps a disclaimer for saying I cannot perhaps speak to the specific language of the bill or the specific approach employed in this bill. I did want to come and share some of my personal experiences in my law practice for why something like this bill is good public policy. I, as I think all of you know, in my day job, I'm a personal injury attorney. I generally sue injured people against wrongdoers, people who are negligent. And in that, within that, I tend to specialize in people who are suffer extreme injuries, often catastrophic injuries. The bad things that happen in life, we all know that they can happen, they disproportionately tend to end up on my desk. It's made me, for example, a much more cautious driver. And those extreme injuries tend to require structured settlements more than just your run-of-the-mill thing. So first of all, let me talk about, I'm assuming many of you perhaps know what a structured settlement is. For those of you, let me just provide some summary. I notice Mr. Nolan Robinson is here. Presumably, he is one of the state's experts in this area. He can go into more detail if you wish. A structured settlement is an instrument. It's a device used when somebody is very, very injured, and there's a fairly large settlement. It's a way to, it's essentially a series of annuities in a way to structure out that settlement so that there are periodic, regular, and relatively low-risk payments in the future. And in the hands of a financial professional such as Mr. Robinson, that can be, for example, if there's a minor child, let's pretend she's injured when she's 5 years old, the settlement can balloon out and pay extra money, for example, between the ages of 18 and 23, when she may or may not be in college. You can do a lot with an appropriate structured settlement. It's often a series of financial instruments in a way that's beneficial, that the interest on the investment doesn't get taxed. That's essentially what a structured settlement is. Again, it tends to be used most frequently in practice for the most injured and the most vulnerable. And I'd like to share with you a couple stories. I'm going to use my client's initials. Indeed, the saddest case I've ever worked on, and keep in mind, I only work on pretty sad cases, but the one that haunts me the most, in fact, I'll try not to get choked up, was a little girl named SK. I might even be able to tell this story, actually. SK was 4 years old in Multnomah County, and she, to make a long story short, she was savagely beaten. She was brain damaged as a result of that. She's today 7 years old. We represented SK and ultimately obtained a settlement. I'm, of course, omitting a lot of details. And as part of that settlement, almost all of it was structured. It was structured for a few reasons. First of all, that's just prudent when you're dealing with a child to try and protect those assets long term. Second of all, SK is severely brain damaged. She'll never be able to work in a competitive environment. And she, when I say she is the sweetest little girl you ever meet, I mean that quite literally. Indeed, it's a function of her brain damage that she's unusually sweet. She lacks certain abilities to discern. If you were to meet her right now, you'd be taken with her. And if you were to ask her to follow you out to your car, she'd do so. She just can't discern. That's exactly the kind of vulnerable person that a structured settlement protects. It protects those assets. Now, SK is perhaps an extreme example. She probably will legally not ever be able to care for herself, so that she couldn't, this bill doesn't address that, because she probably couldn't herself unwind or sell her structured settlement. But let me give you another example. This is one I've been working on, indeed have just finalized, actually since session began in the last month or so. This was a girl who didn't suffer any brain trauma. She had an injury when she was 5 years old that ultimately ruined her kidneys. She's now 8 years old. She is on kidney transplant. There was a large settlement on that. She's going to need periodic transplants for the rest of her life. This hopefully will help manage that. And again, there was a structured settlement involved in that case, actually a series of them. And that is exactly, she, when she turns 18, will be the legal custodian of her structured settlement. And she, at that time, will have the right to essentially cash in her structured settlements, which were designed with a financial professional and obtain judicial approval. All that happened in the last few months. That will be her right, but in order to do that, the current law is she has to petition a judge for permission to do so. However, the problem that this bill addresses is right now judges don't really have any guidance in statute from us as a matter of public policy about what criteria they should look at about whether or not to let that happen. Financially speaking, it's almost never a good idea to essentially cash in these structured settlements for cash today. I think it's in practice very rare that you actually get a real present value of what that structured settlement is. And if it were the case, we wouldn't structure the settlement to begin with. We don't have to structure the settlement. If we needed cash today, we'd simply have a normal settlement. That's the default. So I think that this is a good bill, or some guidance is necessary to judges so that they have some criteria to look at. I'm not saying that there's never a time. I'm not saying that they should never have the ability to cash in a structured settlement. Life changes, things happen, circumstances change. But I am saying that I think it's wise for this body to give some guidance to judges. I think they would appreciate it. I spoke too long, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I got a little emotional there. But if the committee has any questions, I'm happy to entertain them.
Thank you. I appreciate your passion for this particular subject, although it was surprising to me, and I appreciate your testimony. Other questions for Representative Barton? I think you made some great points, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your other committee to come down here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Revisit.
I just have one quick question.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. I apologize. I'm not an attorney, so I need a definition. Can you tell me what domicile means?
Generally, Mr. Chair.
I think I understand, but I was...
And Representative Smith, domicile is typically where you sleep at night. Generally speaking, that's it's distinct from a residence, which is actually a legal term. You can be a resident of somewhere, but actually be domiciled elsewhere. It's
perfect. Thank you. Thank you for that definition.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Next up, Earl Nesbitt. Welcome to the committee this afternoon, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not Earl Nesbitt, but I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland with the Romaine Group, and I'm here to introduce our new client, Earl Nesbitt, who's the Executive Director and General Counsel for the National Association of Settlement Purchasers. And we are neutral on the bill, and Earl will explain a little more detail on it. We think that actually with a few people sitting down, we can work out something on this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I just found out about this hearing yesterday, and I'm from Texas, so I'm not had a lot of sleep. And I've
And if you would introduce yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I am Earl Nesbitt. I'm Executive Director of the National Association of Settlement Purchasers.
Thank you.
So I'm glad to be here today to speak to this bill. As Paul stated, we are not opposed to the bill in concept. We do believe that portions of the bill need to be addressed and discussed and negotiated, and I think we think it's very important that this committee understand the concept, the concepts in question. First, you should understand that the business that I represent is not a large business. It's very much a niche business. The vast majority of people who, as Representative Barton stated, who have structured settlements, receive those for a reason. They continue to receive all their payments as scheduled for their entire term, and they never have a need or a desire to have liquidity. But there are a certain percentage, anywhere from between 5 to 8% of people who have structured settlements at some time in their lives have something happen, or something, you know, maybe a divorce, a bankruptcy, a medical condition, loss of a job, something, who have a need for this service, and that's called the secondary market. And our members provide liquidity to those people. To give you some reference point here, in Oregon last year, our members completed 149 transactions statewide. Our members constitute about 90% of the secondary market, so we can guesstimate about 180, 185 Oregonians, if that is a word, completed transactions last year. Every one of them was court approved. But so it's not a large business. I'm here to speak on behalf of our members, but I'm also here to speak on behalf of our customers, our members. My office has been working diligently over the last 24 hours to contact real Oregonians who've completed these transactions. And we've made contact with four or five people who couldn't be here today, but they do want to speak to this at the same time. These are people who went through the process, who went to court, who are 43-year-old mother of two, a 37-year-old landscape fellow in Deschutes County, Oregon.
Deschutes, sorry.
I can't read my own writing. An engineer in Benton County whose husband is an ER doctor. These are the people who are taking advantage of these liquidity options. It's not the poor SK that Representative Barton indicated, and that transaction would never be approved. You can't do a transaction with a minor. You can't do a transaction with an incompetent. Every one of these must be court approved. But these people are the ones who have to go to court, and they will be heard on this at some point in the future. We just couldn't get them here today. But as I said, we're not opposed to 100% of the bill. There are parts of the bill that we completely support. I think it's you're the sponsor of the bill, Representative Holy, and one of the things you advocate is extending the initial disclosure time from 3 days to 10 days. We would support that. One of the things that's in the bill that requires a disclosure to the court of prior transfers, we think that's important information. Our members disclose that now. We would support that being part of the bill. But there are parts of it that we do have some concerns of, and more importantly, we think our customers have some concerns with. That adds a 30-day, IPA disclosure waiting period. Right now, there's a 3-day waiting period. Then you have to have 20 days before you can have a hearing. And in effect, from the time you make a decision to complete this transaction to the time you get court approval and get it funded, it's about 60 to 90 days. In some places, it's more than that because we understand some courts are strapped for time and money, as they are all over the country. We're going to add another 30 days on top of that on the front end. That's going to add cost. That's going to add time. And I will tell you that most of the people who come to us have exhausted their other avenues. They've either maxed out their credit cards. They don't have a line of credit they can access. They've borrowed from friends. And so when they come to us, they may be looking at foreclosure. They may have been out of work for a period of time. So it's important that we not extend too far out the period of time frame, so they have to have 6 months. Another thing that we are really concerned about is some of the disclosures that must be made in these public filings. Right now, there is certain information that must be provided about the terms of the transaction. Then when the person goes to court, the judges will often have questions about why they want to do this. What are their other sources of income? Things like that. Those are all very legitimate questions that the payee ought to be. Payee is the person who's completing the transaction under the statute. They ought to be prepared to answer, and they ought to have legitimate reasons. But at the end of the day, it is an asset that they own, and they ought to have some deference should be given to mature individuals, adults who can make their own decisions about their financial assets. What this bill does is it requires those same individuals to disclose information about their medical condition in court records that are filed in public record and available to anyone to look at. Disclose information about their financial resources, about their income, about their spouse's financial resources and income. And for example, Representative Barton talked about in some of their structured settlements, they may have multiple annuities. Well, if we had an individual who had two annuities, one was paying him monthly payments, one paid him lump sum payments, he needed to liquidate some of the lump sum payments because to pay off some credit card debt and to make a transition to make a move to another state for job reasons. Well, to require him to come in and disclose information about that other annuity that is not at issue, I can certainly understand where someone might not want to do that. They might not want to have that in a public record. That's not to say that the judge doesn't have the right to ask about that when they go to. They absolutely, the judge needs to understand their financial condition. But when you talk about medical conditions, I believe that violates HIPAA, federal law. It requires us, our members who are completing these transactions, to ask these people about their medical conditions, so that then, because we're the ones who have to file the application, we're the ones responsible for providing this information to the court. We have to get that information from the annuitant or the payee, and I can certainly understand that. Why are you asking me about my medical condition? Why are you asking me about my health care? All I want to do is liquidate a portion of my future payments. So it's those kind of things that the bill, we believe, kind of overreaches in some areas. That's not to say that we can't work with this committee or Representative Barton or Chairman Holvey or anyone who's interested in this issue. We can and we have. We've always supported legislation that requires court approval, a gatekeeper, if you will, of these transactions. We supported the federal legislation that imposes an excise tax on transactions that are done that are not court approved under an applicable state statute. We supported the Oregon transfer statute when it was enacted back, I believe, in 2005. And we certainly support the concept. We don't want bad apples in our industry, and bad apples are not going to be in an industry where you got to go in front of a judge every time you want to complete a transaction and justify that. So we're certainly not against that. We want to support that, but we have to be cognizant of the fact that these people have very legitimate concerns about having to disclose in court records that are going to be filed and there forever very intimate, confidential, private details about their finances, their health, their children. One of the things requires you got to disclose the age of your minor children and the address where they're living. Now, I don't have any minor children anymore. Mine are in college, and that's why I'm going to work till I'm about 90. but if I had a 5-year-old or a 6-year-old, I certainly wouldn't want to put in open court, hey, I've got an annuity that pays me $2,000 a month, and I've got a job that pays me $5,000 a month, and my children live at this address. I don't want that in public record, and I don't think most of the people that we do business with. So having said all that, we believe in concept the bill can achieve some of the goals that Chairman Holvey and Representative Barton have stated they want to achieve, and we want to work with the committee and Oregonians to get a bill that balances those interests. And I'll answer any questions if you have them. Otherwise, I really, really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Thank you. Questions from the committee on this? Well, oddly enough, I have a couple. So I'm curious, who are your members? I mean, what specific companies are members of your association?
It's a small business. There's 16 what we call funding company members right now. Anywhere from the largest one is J.G. Wentworth. You've probably seen their stupid ads. the opera singer. I guess that's recorded. That should probably not get back to my client.
Yes, they're wonderful.
The smallest company is a company called Annuity Transfers out of Dallas. It's like 3 or 4 people. So those are the funding company members. In addition, the attorneys who go to court in Oregon and elsewhere, and I'm an attorney, and I represent companies in getting court approval of transfers in Texas, where I practice law, we are also members of the trade association. There's about 80 or 90 attorney members from around the country.
Thank you. And so, you know, one of the concerns that always pops up that highlighted this for several people, including myself, were some of the advertisements that come out in late night TV by Peachtree, I believe, which is an affiliate is part of J.G. Wentworth, which is not really a small company, who basically advertise in terms of trying to convince people that, hey, it's your money, you can have it, and really is leading people to this conclusion. And in U.S. News last year, I believe, they came out with what they're actually getting for these annuities. It's really not much money when you have a $67,000
set of series of payments that J.G. Wentworth gives you $16,000 for it up front. And, you know, those discount rates are really of a huge concern to me when we have a state that has recognized 36% is anything above that's usury. These sorts of discounts on the money that's theirs that they can get now seems very, very high. It's my understanding that this company or this industry really doesn't have any state or federal regulation on these sorts of practices.
Actually, there's 48 states have transfer statutes, and the United States Congress passed 26.
I understand they have transfer statutes without really identifying what the best interest of the client is, which is one of the problems. But I was speaking more to what is the norm for, or are there any standards for what you give on the dollar for cashing out these future income streams?
Every transaction is different, but I can give you an average. We did a study in Texas of 105 transactions during a certain period of time, and of those, I think 85 had been decided by the time. There were still 20 pending. But anyway, and something like 91% of those were approved. The average discount rate on that, which is akin to an interest rate, was 12.98%. There was one that was real high, 72%. I'll tell you exactly what it was. Someone selling a $6,000 lump sum payment due in 9 months, and they got, $3,400. But because it was so small and so short term, the cost of the transaction was $3,000 or $4,000. So that skewed the discount rate. The low on that in that study was about 7.7. One of the ladies one of the individuals I talked to, my office talked to, the discount rate on her deal, and I think that was the one in
Klamath Falls.
I'm going to butcher all the names. Klamath Falls was an 8.6 rate. I would say the average is between 11 and 14. They do get higher if it's a small short-term transaction, but they get lower for larger transactions. And that's the other thing you need to understand is the vast majority of these transactions involve someone who is receiving $2,000 a month and they're selling $500 a month to buy a handicapped accessible van, which was the lady in Klamath Falls.
That's okay. We know what you mean.
So the vast majority of transactions are or just a portion of their payments. But that's an example of the discount rates. With respect to your advertising, you know, I don't know what to tell you on that. That is protected speech. That is advertising. There's no way to find people who have structured settlements because the vast majority of people who enter into a structured settlement do so in an out-of-court settlement, in a confidential settlement, and no one knows what the terms of that settlement are other than the parties. So the only way our members have to get to those people is to advertise. J.G. Wentworth, Peachtree are the largest. They advertise on television. Almost everyone else, all they do is advertise on the internet or make their services available to plaintiffs' personal injury attorneys like Mr. Barton, who have clients who at some point in their future, usually if they have a need to liquidate, the first call they're going to make is to the attorney who put them in the settlement. And so a lot of people go to conventions of plaintiffs' personal injury attorneys.
So what percentage of the market does J.G. Wentworth and Peachtree have in this industry?
Involving NAS members, because I don't have all the data on non-NAS members. I would say J.G. Wentworth Peachtree probably has combined probably 55, maybe 57% of the market. But that's a guess right now. In a couple of weeks, I'll probably have the data for the 2012 is what we just finished, and I'll have a little better feel for that. But that's probably not too far off. That's an educated guess, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you. Just a clarification. When you say 11% discount rate, that means that if it was $100,000, $89,000 would be paid to the person in present money? Is that what you're saying? And that $11,000 would be taken as the cost? I mean, what do you mean
if,
you
if the
9 to 11%?
If the $100,000 payment was due in 1 year, then it's an annual rate calculation. So it would be 11% rate. If it's due in 2 years, it would be eleven percent for 2 years, just like a loan or a mortgage. You basically calculate it the same way you do a loan or a mortgage. So if the payments are due way out in the future, a discount rate of 11% might result in someone getting $20,000 for $100,000. But if it's due, you know, 1 year from now, they would get, like you said, $89,000. And that's another important thing. The discount rate is not the end-all here. Because sometimes I will tell you, I will look at a transaction and say, this person is better off selling a lump sum payment that they're due 18 months from now at an 18% discount rate than selling monthly payments that go out 7 years at a 10% discount rate. Even though they got a lower discount rate on the monthly sum payment than the lump sum transaction, they're better off because they're going to give up less money in the future and they're going to keep that monthly income. That's why we supported court review of every transaction, because every transaction, every circumstance, every payee is different. And you have to be able to present that to the court, have the payee there. They come to court, they testify, they're very nervous, they're very upset, they have to go in front of a judge and explain to a stranger why they want to do something with an asset that they own. And so it's sometimes difficult to get that information out of them. But every transaction in Oregon and every other state has to be court approved. And in Oregon, every transaction requires, every court that I know of, requires the payee to come in person, look the judge in the eye, yes sir, no sir, yes ma'am, no ma'am, answer their questions, and establish the right to receive their payments. Obviously, we are there as well. Our counsel, we're required to file the transfer application.
And I appreciate that, but as Representative Barton had mentioned, and I've talked to a few judges in this arena, that, you know, they really don't have the criteria that helps them establish that best interest of the client, and have difficulty coming up with the reasoning to actually deny these requests. And you know, that's one of the reasons for this bill, is to provide the court some criteria to establish you know, the best interest of the client, and thinking that's fairly reasonable. And the other piece that you brought out, you know, that I will talk to you about, and through Mr. Romaine, or you know, if you leave, or over the phone, was really protecting the privacy interests of the client. The attorneys I've talked to on this feel that this bill actually does do that, and those documents that are sensitive are not going to be disclosed to the public. So we'll have to have that discussion later on, I'm sure.
Be happy to do it.
Yeah, great. So any other questions of this panel? I appreciate your time, and I appreciate you making the trip out here. You know, it's good. I'm sorry it was such short notice for you. I can't explain that.
that's my fault, I'm sure.
That's our process, I suppose. but anyway, thank you very much, and safe travels to you.
Thank you.
Next up, I have the last testifier, Nolan Robinson.
Hopefully, on my return, I'll brush up on my pronunciation.
Get you out of here.
Welcome.
They aren't any.
And good afternoon. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. My name is Nolan Robinson.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I am a certified structured settlement consultant with 10 plus years of settlement planning experience, the last 9 of which have been here in Oregon. As a settlement planner, my job is to make sure that people who are injured in accidents is to help them secure their financial futures. Oftentimes these are people who, because of their injuries, have a diminished earning capacity. You know, in some very extreme cases, like those Representative Barton mentioned, it's you know, they have no earning capacity, and others it's just injuries that prevent them from doing so. But they're relying on these structured settlement annuities to help pay their basic necessities, rent, food, all that sort of stuff. Unfortunately, they're often not very sophisticated when it comes to financial matters. You know, the structured settlement for them represents a way for them to manage their finances easily while getting a competitive return on their money. That's lack of sophistication, though, does sort of make them vulnerable to the cash now advertisements that we've already discussed, and I share his feelings on the quality of the commercials. But in any event, these cash now companies, they are preying on vulnerable people who don't necessarily have the tools to make the best decision for themselves. They don't understand the expenses. They don't understand discount rates. I was talking about it with Chair Holvey at one point, and he was asking, so what do you mean by discount rate? And I think it's important. 11% discount rate doesn't sound exorbitant. But year after year after year, you know, I mean, it 10 years, even at 8%, doesn't sound like a lot. But when you can go to the buy a bond, a 10-year treasury bond, which is as secure as they come, and only get 2%, there's certainly a big gap there, and I think that bears review. I'm not saying that there's not a place for the factoring industry, and factoring is the people in my industry refer to settlement purchasers as factoring companies, so I apologize for throwing yet another term at you, but I think there is a need. You know, occasionally there's someone who has a genuine hardship and no other alternatives and they need to access their money. But I'm not sure, actually I'm quite sure, that they don't have the tools necessary to make those decisions. One of the things I really like about this bill is the inclusion of the ability to hire a professional, whether it's an attorney or a certified public accountant or a financial professional, to review it and make sure that the rate that they're getting is reasonable. One thing that's not addressed in here, but I've heard of in other states that I think is reasonable, is putting some sort of cap on the discount rate that they can take. And that's up for debate and certainly can be discussed, but there needs to be a reasonableness to whatever that discount is. Because in my eyes, for an example, I looked into this a little while ago and was told that for a $50,000 payment due in 10 years, the amount that I would be able to get back was around $21,000, which represents about a 9% discount. Sounds reasonable, 9%. But if I were to sell one of these annuities that funded the $50,000 in the first place and give them $50,000 in 10 years, it would cost me probably close to $44,000. Again, a big gap there between that 21,000 and 40 plus. In any event, we can't really guarantee that everybody's going to make the right decisions at the time of settlement or after settlement when they're experiencing a hardship, and probably the time between when they put themselves in that hardship. But I think it's imperative that we give them the tools and the resources to make the best possible decision. So I thank you for your time and consideration, and I'm certainly welcome to happy to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any states that have caps?
I understand that West Virginia has a cap. The drafter of that legislation was a structured settlement broker who also was a member of the House at the time. And that legislation capped it at the, I think, the 15-year mortgage rate. I'm not advocating for a number, mm-hmm. but it's the concept that I do support.
Thank you. And maybe this isn't a fair question of you, and I should have asked Mr. Nesbitt this, but what do these factoring companies obviously they're buying a future income stream. What do they do with that future income stream? Does that just become part of their portfolio? Or do they turn around and sell that to somebody else? Or what's the...
Well, thank you, Chair. I would imagine that most of them, they just get their money when it's due. I do understand that there's now a secondary market for these annuities. We call them refactored annuities. So somebody who is, and it may well be someone who's just looking to add some retirement income to their portfolio. It may be someone who is dealing with a post-injury settlement. And so rather than go through the what I'll call traditional market for annuities, for structured settlements, because there really aren't a ton of companies that offer structured settlement annuities, because it is relative, there's greater tax implications to the language that needs to go in there. So it takes some resources. Some of them, instead of buying a traditional structured settlement annuity, will fund it through a refactored annuity, which, you can make your determination on whether or not you feel that's appropriate or not. But it's so they are bought and resold. I don't know the frequency of it, but I do know that it exists.
Thank you. Other questions? Not seeing any. I appreciate you making the effort to come testify on this issue and your expertise on the matter as well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close.
If you want, we can answer a couple of questions.
No, certainly. If you want to come back up.
Yes, sir.
So my question was, I suppose the question was, when you purchase these future income streams, do you then repackage them and sell them again?
Some
and
do.
Restate your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Earl Nesbitt with the National Association of Settlement Purchasers. The answer to your question is it depends on the company. The larger companies, obviously, J.G. Wentworth, Peachtree, who are buying large pools of these all around the country, they typically would package them and then securitize them, similar to auto loans or home loans using Wall Street money. Some of the smaller companies would sell them to pension funds. I've seen 401k, groups. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, IRA investors groups, investment groups who buy them, pool them, and use those to fund retirements for people or high net worth individuals. Some do hold them on portfolio. Just some of the smaller companies, they're just kind of churning a set fund. So it really depends. But to answer your question, with respect to the larger companies that are doing this a lot, doing the vast majority of the transactions nationwide, yes, they're packaging them.
Thanks. It's always when I first looked at this, I thought they were insurance products, but they're actually financial products, is it?
The repackage, yeah, they're basically bonds. Mm-hmm. They issue bonds backed by this pool of structured settlement payments that are all over the place as far as how many, how long they go out, whether they're lumps or monthlies, but they're all court approved ultimately.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you making that clarification for us.
Sure. Thank you again.
Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing on so long, I forgot the name of the bill. House Bill 2536. And I think we have one more bill left. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2059. Bob, would you like to give us a brief little description of the bill, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2059 adds consignment sales to existing law governing auctions and adds certain responsibilities for both consignees and auctioneers, adds consignment sales to existing unlawful trade practice provision for auctions, and it exempts certain consignment sales.
Thank you. I appreciate that description. And I know we have Eva Novick and Aaron Knott still waiting. Probably totally entertained by our subject matter today, but welcome. So if you identify yourself for the record, please.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the Legislative Director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. I come to you today in support of House Bill 2059, which would extend some needed regulation to an area which right now really doesn't have enough, which is consignment sales. First of all, to give you a sense of what we mean by that, the basic principle of consignment, of course, is you give someone your property to sell on your behalf, the theory being they do so, and they do so as fairly as possible, and then they keep some portion fairly in exchange for their services, and the rest goes back to you. This is most obviously done with your sort of furniture, jewelry, antique type of consignment, but it can be broader than that. And the most obvious way, or the most obvious location in which this is carried out, are stores, consignment stores that are dedicated to that effect, but it can happen in a lot of other contexts. There consigners that will, say, come into your home if you're in the context of an estate sale, or if you have a person who's maybe moving into full-time medical care and something needs to be done with their property. Consigners will come in and actually carry that out from the property itself. So it's a pretty broad variety of property covered, and it's a fairly high complaint area for us. Since 2007, we've received 273 allegations or contacts claiming that a consignor had failed to pay the consignee. And there are a number of different ways that this can take place. One of the sort of more egregious is if you sort of set up a buyer yourself as the consignor. You know, you have your buddy buy something that you like. It's worth, you know, it's worth $300, and they buy it from you in consignment for some fraction of that, and then you guys work out some sort of an agreement, and you basically get to keep it for yourself. Now, consignment is adjacent in a lot of ways to auction, but the legal structure isn't. There are a number of regulations for auctioneers and auction houses. They're required to state their name in advertisements. They can't simply say, we will sell your stuff and provide a phone number. They have to make an affirmative effort to sell property that they're offering for sale. They can't make that straw man type purchase I was just talking about, where they basically stop operating an arm's length and have a buddy or somebody else that they know come in and underbid on an auction to so that they can benefit from it. And they're required to actually maintain some basic trust and accounting principles in terms of making a recordation of the transaction and operating a trust account. And these, and maybe most importantly of all, they're subject to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. So if you get into really egregious violations where you actually have an affirmative act of fraud, or in other way a consumer being misled, we can take steps to punish that conduct via the UTPA. But when you turn over to consignment, those protections are absent. House Bill 2059 proposes to move consignment into the already existing structure of protections that exist for auction houses and auctioneers currently housed at ORS 698-640. It's a kind of gray area, or even dark area, in the regulatory structure right now, and it's a real need for consumers. So with that, I'll turn it over to our resident practitioner at the Department of Justice, Eva Novick.
My name is Eva Novick. I am an Assistant Attorney General in the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section, and I am mostly here to answer your questions if you have any.
Thank you. I appreciate...
That's a comment, not a question.
Certainly.
I appreciate you bringing this to me. One of the pieces of testimony that was sent in is one of my constituents, and I represent an area that has two very large retirement communities, and there are lots of estate sales, and I'm just talking about your garage sale that's on a Sunday afternoon, but estate sales that are entire homes full of they're kind of upscale retirement communities with some very, very important pieces, and I have gotten numerous complaints and have told them to call the Department of Justice about people who have come in with estate sales, no contract, no nothing, no whatever, saying, oh, it looks like your stuff's worth $8,000, and they end up getting $1,000. And it's really a large issue in areas that have retirement communities, both by King City and Summerfield. So I'm glad to see this kind of legislation, because it is big, and as I say, Mr. Pingren wrote a piece of testimony about his experience a couple of years ago, and it was back in 2003, but it happens over and over and over and over again, especially in the senior communities.
Yes, and since you brought it up, Representative Doherty, Mr. Pingra does have testimony that he submitted to the committee that's in our OLA system as well. And I will chime in. A couple years ago, I had a piece of legislation similar to this one before, and it came up through a constituent issue who had an estate sale operator come in, and at the end of the sale, there were several pieces that were unaccounted for, and there was no accounting or no proof, and you know, it's a devastating thing to have happen. Oftentimes when it's, you know, the property of a deceased relative or something that has some value. So and it surprised me that there really is no particularly regulation around or sideboards around these types of operations and sales. So I know there's a lot of examples, and certainly I think there's been some stories over the years in the Oregonian on KGW about this issue, and it's difficult to get people to testify on this because they feel like they were stupid, and they don't want to come and say, gee, I was stupid, I got ripped off. So they're very hesitant to come forward with those stories, but certainly we're aware of them. Are there other questions from the committee?
Well, I think if I just add one more thing, in a lot of these estates, it's a considerable amount of money.
Yeah.
A considerable amount of money. So that was my big concern, was that sometimes it's tens of thousands of dollars worth of goods that are in these people's homes.
And Chair Holby, yeah. Representative Doherty, that's a point that we do want to emphasize. I think with consignment, it's often easy to think that this is a store, that this is, you know, somebody getting rid of some jewelry or getting rid of some furniture. But the migration is in that direction, where you're talking larger dollars. Some of the complaints we get are quite high dollar, and sometimes quasi-estate or full estate sales, where you're talking about an entire home worth of goods being dealt with all at once, and in very emotionally trying circumstances, sometimes when somebody has just passed away or they're moving into full-time residential medical care, and a lot of distractions in that situation.
Right, and this bill falls short of actually licensing or registering or, you know, those operators, but does put at least some teeth into help, you know, I guess our statutes and the Attorney General to help consumers who've been harmed in these arenas. So, any other thoughts or questions from the committee on this bill? I appreciate your continued interest in this for a couple of years, because I do think it's an area that we need some stronger protections in. So thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With that, I will note I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2059 after having registered Mr. Pingler's testimony. And I'm going to reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2536 just for the point of putting on the record. We did receive testimony from Don Corson, and that testimony should be in your OLA system as well. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2536. Bob, do we have any other business for the committee today? Thank you for that. Thank you for your attention, committee. These are big issues and sometimes tough to get your head around, I know. Very complicated, but I think they're very important. So with that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.